Hi, everyone, and welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. This is Matt. My blog is cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And this is Andrew, and my blog is thestopbutton.com.
And in this episode, we're going to do a double feature, another H.G. Wells double feature. We didn't plan it out that way, but that's how it happened. Last episode was The Invisible Men. This episode is The Moreaus. Dr. Moreau, Island of Dr. Moreau, the story that he wrote after Invisible Man. It's been adapted three times majorly. We're taking a look at the first one and the most recent one. The one in the middle from the 70s with Michael York is supposed to be really good. I haven't seen it. Have you?
No, I haven't. But
it's probably a happy middle between the two, even though the one from the 30s, the first one that we're going to talk about, Island of Lost Souls, is really, really good. But I'm sure the one from the 70s is a little less of a horror film and more of an intellectual one. The one from 96, just called The Island of Dr. Moreau, has been famous for a long time, or infamous as, like, you know, a bomb and a really bad movie. We'll get to that second. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be, but it was still pretty bad. Anyways, Island of Lost Souls from 1932. This would have been the year before The Invisible Man, by the way. And it's very much a horror film. It actually gets lumped in with the Universal horror films of the era, even though it's a Paramount movie. But it looks like when it was released on video, it was through Universal Home Video Monsters Classic Collection. So it was kind of, you know, after the fact incorporated into that library of Universal horror movies. It's creepy. It's very tight. It's like an hour and 20. And it inspired Devo because of the scene where they chant, where Bela Lugosi, as the Sayer of the Law, chants, "Are we not men?" And then all the animal mutants in the jungle chant, "Are we not men?" It was recently re-released on Criterion. So, you know, if you need intellectual justification for enjoying this movie, there you go. and in the essay that accompanies the Criterion release, it makes a good point that it's sort of impossible to view this through, you know, without thinking of everything that it's inspired. But a lot of H.G. Wells stuff is like that. We kind of went into this in the Invisible Man episode. It's like, you know, the guy came up with all these science fiction tropes that we take for granted, like alien invasion and time travel and invisibility and genetic engineering. In this case, this was the original cautionary, scary science fiction tale about genetic engineering gone awry. I didn't even realize, but Wells was alive to see this movie. He was alive to see The Invisible Man, too. He didn't die until like 47. And according to the Wikipedia page for Island of Lost Souls, he really didn't like this one because because they emphasized it, you know, into a horror film. But isn't that, you know, I would have to ask, like, wasn't that sort of the point, to, you know, make us horrified and revulsed at the idea of what Dr. Moreau is doing? I haven't read, unlike Invisible Man, I haven't read the original novel, so I kind of can't compare. But one interesting major difference, just looking at a summary of the novel, is that apparently the novel doesn't have any kind of sexy cat lady. Yeah, but that's become a staple of the other two movie versions of Island of Dr. Moreau, is that the guy, you know, whoever the protagonist is who winds up shipwrecked on Moreau's island, one of the first natives he inhabits is, you know, a sexy island girl who at first it just seems like she don't speak the English too good, but then it becomes apparent that she hasn't been speaking English for that long because she was, you know, only turned into a human last week from a cat, or in this case, a panther. And probably Wells' hatred of this movie started with the poster, I'm guessing, which just has this like topless looking, you know, girl in the foreground of the jungle. And you know, Island of Lost Souls with Charles Laughton, Bela Lugosi, Richard Arlen, Leela Hyams, and the Panther Woman. and she's like the selling point. The tagline of Island of Lost Souls is, "The Panther Woman, lured men on, only to destroy them, body and soul." So pretty exploitative, but the movie isn't, you know, nearly so exploitative. And well, I don't know. It kind of is. I mean, this is a pre-code movie, and the Panther lady played by what is her name here? It's kind of also the fact that she's credited as the Panther lady, not just on the poster, but in the opening credits. Oh, Kathleen Burke really reminded me of it reminded me of two things. The Invisible Man, which credits Claude Rains in the opening title titles as the Invisible One, and even more so Frankenstein,
right,
not crediting Boris Karloff, but just giving, you know, the monster ... question mark as his credit. So in the pre-IMDb days, this is what they used to do. They used to make you try to convince you that they got a real monster to play Frankenstein, or they got a real Panther lady to play the Panther lady. But I mean, she's totally, you know, one of the best things about the movie. And also she's kind of like necessary to the story, because without her, all the animal people of Moreau's Island are just monsters basically, but she's like the sympathetic one. And yeah, and she's very, you know, it's a very kind of overtly sexual aspect of the movie, because pretty soon it becomes clear that the reason that Moreau has allowed the sailor to remain on his island is because he's going to attempt to mate the Panther woman with this guy. So pretty risque stuff for 1932, to say nothing of all the, you know, all the horrific mutant animal stuff happening.
And then, of course, when the guy's girlfriend comes to the island to rescue him, the Dr. Moreau's response is, you know, he doesn't really need to mate with the Panther lady anymore, because, you know, the one of the higher functioning, sort of mid-range functioning ape men takes a liking to the girl. So Dr. Yeah. Moreau's like, it might work itself out. And you're just kind of watching it, and you're like, what a difference a year made in the code. Like, where would movies have been by 37 if there had never been a code?
Yeah. And what's also interesting about the title change, Island of Lost Souls from Island of Dr. Moreau, is, you know, obviously it's more attention grabbing than Dr. Moreau, because if you don't know who that is, then why would you care? But also, the term Lost Souls was typically used to refer to sexual slavery and, you know, white slavery and people being kidnapped to have to go work in brothels. So, and you look at the poster, it doesn't imply any mutant animal people. You just see shipwrecked sailors and the Panther lady, who doesn't, you know, have fur on her or anything. It's mostly a performance that implies that she used to be an animal. But yeah, you look at the title and the tagline, lured them on to destroy them body and soul, you might think that's a sexual slavery picture, but you know, white slavery, but no.
Well, and so this is a what's interesting about it being Paramount is that Paramount didn't do too many horror movies that I can think of. MGM did a couple ones that are still famous today, but I didn't realize it was a Paramount movie sort of thrown into that Universal had sort of adopted as one of its own monster movies. When they, in the 60s, Universal bought like 2,000 home video rights of Paramount classics, and so it was one of them. But because the movie's very, it's also Charles Laughton's, one of his first movies. So it's this incredible, because everybody knows who Charles Laughton's career was 20, 30 years, probably. I mean, he 57 or so. So, I mean, he's very well known and not a genre actor. And I feel like Island of Lost Souls would have been not a B picture for Paramount in 32. Like, they had, you know, they obviously put a lot behind it because it looks great. Yeah.
And Bela Lugosi was already famous as Dracula. Like in the trailer, they bill him as Bela Dracula Lugosi, despite the fact that that wasn't their movie.
Yeah. So, and then, yeah, Lugosi. Yeah. It's,
Yeah, a couple of years later, yeah, Charles Laughton plays Captain Bligh in Mutiny on the Bounty. That's probably the movie that made him famous first. But, I guess this wasn't a big hit or anything, but it's the lasting impact. I mean, it goes well beyond Devo. For some reason, new wave and punk bands really take to this movie. Oingo Boingo did a song about loosely based on Island of Dr. Moreau as well, where they're chanting "What is the law?" and such. But yeah, it was obvious. I guess it played on TV a lot. Like that's where I remember reading some Mark Mothersbaugh interview where he's talking about watching Island of Lost Souls on like the midnight horror show. As an impressionable young boy, and they're chanting "What is the law?" and that stuck with him. But the Panther Lady also stuck around for the later 70s version. So this is one of those cases where like the movie version is more famous than the novel and kind of becomes the template for all future adaptations, even when the future adaptations try to be truer to the material. And as a horror film, I guess what really makes it work is not, Bela Lugosi with fur stapled to his face, but Charles Laughton is such a creep in this. And he's a very effeminate little creep too, with his like Van Dyke beard and his whip. And I think when I was a kid, I remember like looking through a book of, horror films of the 30s, and there was a publicity photo of Charles Laughton behind bars, like with just this maniacal expression on his face. And I was so creeped out by this like maniacal looking little fat man with a whip. I just thought, like, God, whatever this guy is up to can't possibly be good. And the title was Island of Lost Souls, and I didn't know that it was about Moreau or even what Moreau was at the time, but it's just, yeah, it's a very memorable image, him with his mincing little beard cracking the whip.
Yeah.
And he's wonderfully kind of self-aggrandizing in a way that even like Frankenstein wasn't in the original Frankenstein. I mean, when you get to Bride of Frankenstein and Dr. Pretorius, you get more into like the egomaniacal mad scientist who can rationalize what he's doing. But Laughton as Moreau is much more diabolical. And when he's kind of like maybe the best scene in the movie is when he's touring this shipwrecked sailor around, Richard Arlen as Edward Parker. When he's touring Richard Arlen around the facility and he shows like the animal man that he's got strapped to a table and he's just like mashing his hands across his face, like, see the work I'm doing here. And then he like gestures to the window and he says, some of my experiments weren't so successful, but now they help, generate the power that runs the other experiments. And like the camera pans over and there's just, some hairy animal men on a wheel, basically. They're turning a wheel and they're just slaves. And it's like, it's definitely, I mean, some of that stuff is definitely from Wells and his kind of obsession, turn of the century Victorian obsession with like the lower classes becoming less than human through exploitation. You see it in The Time Machine with the division between the Morlocks and who are underground and the Eloi who are above ground and living off of the Morlocks' labor. Yeah, really, the Panther Lady is probably why Wells didn't like this version. I have to guess because it adds in this element of sexuality. But another good point raised by that Criterion release supplemental essay is that by having the Panther Lady in there, it's also getting at the idea of miscegenation and interbreeding between the races. Because when this movie was made, and certainly when Wells wrote the novel, people basically regarded other races as other species. So the idea of, trying to elevate other lower races, quote unquote, to the level of humans was something to be horrified by. And certainly interbreeding was something to be horrified by. And with Welles, I'm never really sure like how much of a fascist or a racist Welles was, because he, in some ways, he very much is. But then on other, he write, you know, the stuff he writes has such a moral conscience about it that you almost get the sense that like he's a racist and a fascist who feels a little guilty about it, and that he expresses that in his science fiction stories. But I don't know. I mean, if the idea of turning animals into men is something to be horrified by, then Island of Lost Souls really does its job. And something that's particularly horrifying too is that unlike in the novel, but also unlike in the 96 version that we're going to talk about, it's never exactly clear what animals these animal men were made from. They're just sort of generic animal men. They look men, but they're hairy, or they have, you know, piggy noses or something. But there's never a scene where Lawton, you know, points out like, and this one was made from a hyena, and this one was made from an ape. They're just, you know, well, like Bela Lugosi intones at the end, you know, not men, not animals, things.
Yeah, it
had you seen this before?
I've never seen it before, no. And yeah, it was my first time seeing it, and I was just it achieves like that status where people should be familiar with it when Lawton shows up, but it's good from the start. On the boat, when they pick him up, the way they handle the Montgomery character in this one's really good. Of course, I haven't read the book either, so I don't have anything to contrast.
Montgomery being Moreau's right-hand man.
But it starts with this long, relatively long, since it's only 80 minutes, introduction where they get in a fight with the captain of this ship, and so that's why the guy gets kicked off the ship, and it's at times it reminded me a little bit of The Most Dangerous Game, but like a good version of that.
It does have something in common with that for sure. It's also got a little bit of King Kong in it, just as far as, you know, the voyage to a mysterious and dangerous island.
Right. And
Earl C. Kent, at first I thought like Earl C. Kenton was the guy who directed Kong, but no. The only other horror films Earl C. Kenton did actually didn't come until later, and they were Frankenstein sequels.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact.
Yeah, in the 40s. Yeah, that's where I knew him from. And I'm a little surprised by this one, because the Universal movies all sort of fit a pattern. They use the same sets, et cetera, et cetera. And by, I don't know, probably 39 was the last one that they spent any money on, Son of Frankenstein. And so getting to see Kenton do something with Island of Lost Souls that, you know, it's, you never get the feeling that his budget was constrained in a way that he couldn't cope with. It never shows if he's got a limited budget.
Well, the makeup effects are kind of like strikingly good for 1932. They really look like, I mean, something that could be, you know, done today. And part of that is the black and white obscures the, you know, the creaks and the creases and the makeup applications and stuff. But for 1932, this is really good stuff.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, because they are on the side of caution, and when they've got the big scenes of animal men milling about, they're in the shadows. So your imagination picks up the slack. I mean, probably the worst makeup in the movie actually is for Bela Lugosi, because he really is. Well, actually, I'm looking at him now, and he kind of looks like a midway stage, like in The Wolfman, when they're doing the lap dissolves over Lon Chaney Jr. He looks like one of those in between stages there, so he doesn't look bad.
Yeah,
it's just a little silly, but you got those Bela Lugosi eyes staring out from the werewolf face, and it's all good. Of course, he can't help his Hungarian accent when he's talking about what is the law, not to walk on all fours, that is the law. Oh, and the reason that I thought it was it might have been Earl C. Kenton who did King Kong is just because King Kong was directed by Marion C. Cooper. It's the same middle initial. That's it.
Yeah, and Cooper, well, Ernest Schoedsack, Ernest B. Schoedsack, co-directed Kong and Most Dangerous Game on the same set. So this was all happening at the same time. Most Dangerous Game and Lost Souls would have come out both in the same year. They both came out in 32. I don't know which one was first, but it's weird that
King Kong was 33, so they had to have been at least filming at the same time.
Yeah, because Joel McRae was going to be in Kong or something like that. But anyway, so with this one, though, it almost feels like a Val Lewton RKO movie from the 40s. A little bit of cat people in there, or the...
Yeah, the Panther Lady.
Panther Lady. And also like White Zombie from what? That's from 32 or 33. And it's these horror movies of the era that, because they didn't have the sort of franchise brand, they sort of have been forgotten until... I mean, I don't know if they've been remembered. I've never seen...
White Zombie... Yeah, I mean, White Zombie, similarly, you know, I don't think Island Lost Souls is public domain, but White Zombie certainly played a lot on TV over the decades in public domain, and it made its mark on people that way. It made its mark on Rob Zombie, certainly, if nobody else.
Yeah, but early 30s horror movies are sort of a...
Well, I guess what's great is, like, they, you know, they didn't have much of a template that had been established yet for how to make a horror movie. Like, they were probably, you know, all they could really go off of was, like, Nosferatu and some of those German expressionist silent movies. So, yeah, they're directed much more like straightforward thrillers, and a lot of the horrific stuff is treated kind of matter-of-factly. Like... You know, the first big creepy scene is when Bela Lugosi is addressing the crowd of animal men in the jungle. And it's not like there's particularly like low angles or high contrast lighting. It's in the dark, sure, but it's kind of presented to you matter of factly. Like the animal men are all just kind of shuffling back and forth, rocking on their feet, chanting, and the camera is just panning out over them. It's like a documentary or something.
Yeah, and then Lawton and the whip. I mean, it...
And the scene I was describing earlier when he's just, like, walking around his mad scientist laboratory showing it off, that also is just, like, very matter-of-fact. There's no creepy, you know, this is the mad scientist laboratory background music. It just, you know... And Lawton is playing it so naturally. Like, this is, you know, this is what he does. This is what his day is like. Just doing vivisections on animal people.
In the House of Pain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, there's another long-lasting influence, the name, the phrase House of Pain. Although there's not much jumping around in this one.
No. Well, a little with the ape men. Yeah, I mean, it's got, trying to think of a way to talk about this without getting into the 98 version too much. I don't know about the original book, but if Wells wanted there to be a lot of interplay between Dr. Moreau and the Beast People...
Yeah, that's actually absent in this version. You get the sense that he presents himself to his creations only to whip him into line.
Right.
There's no kind of love whatsoever. He's not referring to them as his.
Right.
But you know, there is a moment where he goes, you know, he says to Richard Arlen, you know, do you know what it feels like to? Do you know what it's like to feel like a god? And I remember in Frankenstein got in trouble because there was a line. I don't even know if it got cut from the original theatrical prints or not. But, you know, Frankenstein says basically the same thing. Yeah, that really bothered people back in the day. It's such a science fiction cliche now to have, you know, some mad scientist declare, you know, now I'm the god, you know, or whatever. But back then, that was just blasphemous.
Yeah, Frankenstein, they got cut until 87. So from like 43 to 87, that line was gone.
Yeah. And apparently, different of Lost Souls, depending on what state you were in at the time, did have different things cut out.
Wow.
Because probably, yeah, no, it was like that. Censorship was regional, basically. And I think a lot of the time, probably what got cut out the most, besides Laudan declaring himself a god, was just like these god-awful flesh-crawling scenes where you hear the animal people screaming in pain from being operated upon while alive. Just again, the scene where I keep going back to here is like the best scene in the movie, probably. That animal guy who's on the table, he's just moaning in pain horribly. It's very creepy stuff. It's not a scary horror movie, but one that just gets under your skin.
Yeah, I mean, the mistreatment of the animal people, but then there's also the sort of get ready for it because of you see the mistreatment early on. Montgomery has an assistant who's an animal person, and when they're on ship, the captain abuses him, and that's what causes Richard Arlen to get stranded on the island. And that's when, Lawton's idea of mating him with the animal lady or the lady. Yeah, and I mean, it's very, it's not quite a genre, but there are a bunch of South Seas adventure dramas, melodramas from the 30s, and it sort of fits into that.
Bird of Paradise.
Yeah, like Bird of Paradise, John Ford's The Hurricane, I think it's called.
Falling in love with the beautiful native island girl was kind of a cliche of that time.
All the Somerset Maugham adaptations, and it was just like a thing because, you know, presumably all you needed was a boat set and some palm trees and you had your island. And so it fits in with those nicely because a lot of those are pre-code. Rain is one of them with Joan Crawford. I think it's from 32 as well. And so, yeah, I mean, you don't get the feeling with it that Paramount was trying to go cheap on it to appeal to a horror audience, which Universal definitely did with their monster movies.
Well, but it's also sort of like the horror audience was being created at this time.
That
kind of set the standard. Even the ones that aren't as well remembered are the ones that were setting the standard. Dracula was only 1 year before this. 31. So yeah. I mean, whatever your the studio's idea of a horror audience was, just whoever went to see Dracula at the time.
It's kind of
Frankenstein also came out in 31, so they're appealing to people who saw Dracula and Frankenstein the year before.
Yeah, well, it's awesome.
It's totally great. And I remember being struck by it. I saw it probably as a teenager on video. And a Devo. I think the reason I saw it was because I was a Devo fan and I had an Oingo Boingo fan. And I knew that this film was an inspiration for more popular songs, especially Devo. Well, I mean, heck, Devo's first album is called Are We Not Men?
And they're
interviewed on the Criterion.
Yeah,
That's a good reason to pick it up to watch that.
Yeah, and there's their proto music video on the Blu-ray too. Yeah, it's a nice job. Criterion did a nice job with it.
Another really horrifying thing that's great is Moreau's death at the end. Charles Laughton gets vivisected on his own operating table by a mob of animal people. Really, really icky stuff. You know, and it's pre-code, but it's Hollywood at the time, which means that they don't show the knives digging into flesh. They just let you know what's going to happen. They show the animal paws reaching for the knives, and then you hear Charles Laughton screaming horribly for about a minute.
Yeah. And you don't see that level of... You don't really see mad scientists that I can think of really get it that bad. Like, he's a more evil mad scientist than what...
Frankenstein?
Well, definitely more than Frankenstein, but, I mean, he's not even... I mean, he's more evil than Pretorius in a lot of ways.
No, that's true.
Yeah, and I feel like they really eased off that in the 40s when Boris Karloff, you know, started playing mad scientist after mad scientist. So, yeah.
And actually, I mean, you know, Wells would have had to have read Frankenstein. It's kind of a natural extension of the ideas in Frankenstein. And it's kind of doing it one better by saying, like, okay, you know, instead of just creating a new human from old humans, what if we could create humans from other living things, which is kind of a even creepier and,
right,
and more ambitious idea if you were to imagine that it could be done in real life.
Okay.
All right, so that does it for Island of Lost Souls, a definite must-see. We're going to take a little break here, and then we'll be right back to talk about the more accurately named but way the heck less enjoyable Island of Dr. Moreau.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
No, you're wrong. All of you are wrong. Every one of you is wrong, wrong, wrong.
No, we're all right. We're all right. Except for him.
And him. And him.
Oh, God in heaven, gentlemen. What is it like to be so wrong? What does it feel like?
To find out who's right or who's wrong, please check out the new season of the As You Watch podcast, available on iTunes and on Stitcher.
And we're back. So, Island of Dr. Moreau from 1996. New Line Cinema. I guess what made this movie most famous or infamous was its really troubled production history. Richard Stanley spent 4 years developing it, and then he was released or let go after a week and a half of directing. Not because of problems with Marlon Brando, as most people assume, but actually because of problems with Val Kilmer. And then they bring in John Frankenheimer, director of, you know, The Manchurian Candidate, and the production continues to go badly, apparently because of Val Kilmer also. And Frankenheimer makes some really funny statements to the press, saying, you know, there's two things I'll never do in my life: climb Mount Everest and work with Val Kilmer again. And well, but then simultaneously to that problem, Marlon Brando is also, well, it's not that he's like forgetting his lines, it's that they're changing the script like the day before they shoot scenes, so he resorts to being fed lines through a radio, through a, you know, little earpiece. And I guess that combined with the fact that Brando just looks so bizarre in this movie, people must have assumed he was, you know, a huge problem with what went wrong with this movie, but he's not bad, actually.
Oh. no, I'm not with you. Oh.
I hadn't seen this before. I mean, he's no Charles Laughton, but, I mean, he's barely in the movie.
He's barely in the movie. That's true. He has three scenes, yeah.
He's kind of not really around long enough to do any damage.
There's a scene in it with him and Fairuza Balk where I just read the trivia that
Fairuza Balk playing the Panther Lady equivalent in this movie.
Yeah, and there's this, you know, it's this heart-wrenching scene where she's like telling him how she's reverting back and stuff, and she's trying really hard, and I actually really like her in this, and he's just like not caring at all. Like, he's not trying, and it's funny because I feel like he's the one who started this sort of gimmick casting with Superman and then to turn around and not even, you know, invest himself in it.
Yeah. And in both films, he plays like a godlike paternal patriarch figure.
But, yeah, so I remember this because Rob Morrow from, this was during, Val Kilmer was in this during his post-Batman Forever boost that lasted for two or three movies. And so he was getting into bigger stuff. And so
like The Saint.
Well, no, The Saint was what he made instead of Batman 4, so that was after he'd quit. So that was, But, yeah, so he did this one, and I guess he was originally going to play the lead, and then it got changed over to him playing Montgomery, which is a far better role in this one, just because the lead is so lame, and Rob Morrow from Northern Exposure quit.
It's very thankless.
And... So I guess Frankenheimer changed the script, and I don't know why New Line thought hiring Frankenheimer for this was a good idea. Sean S. Cunningham would have been a better choice for directing this, but I think they must have gone with somebody that Brando would agree to work with. Yeah. I mean, it's just...
Well, I don't... Let's talk about like where it starts to go wrong. Because
okay.
When it starts out, it's very straightforward. Yeah, you've got David Thewlis, is that how you pronounce it? Yeah, he's playing the protagonist and he's being suitably, you know, credible, and he meets up with Val Kilmer as Montgomery and they're going to the island. I think I started to worry a little bit, like about 10 minutes in, where Val Kilmer just snaps a bunny's neck for seemingly no reason. I mean, it's so that they have something for dinner later, but that's not clear at the time. And it just seems like a little bit of a showboating from Kilmer. Like, oh, there's something a little off about this guy, but it's a little too exaggerated. Anyways, they go to the, you know, Moreau's house, essentially. Thewlis meets up with Fairuza Balk, and like you said, she's good. I mean, you even kind of believe for a few minutes that she's not an animal person until, you know, you remember that you've just seen Island of Lost Souls and this is the new panther lady. But then they start about 10 minutes later, when Thewlis happens upon like an operating room full of animal people. It's suddenly way too much too soon, because they've been building this up for 20 minutes and you haven't seen any animal people or Marlon Brando for that matter. But then all of a sudden it's just, they just lay all their cards out on the table. Like suddenly you're looking at a lot of extras, really elaborate, grotesque makeup. They've completely dropped any pretense of building up suspense. And then like, in the next 10 minutes, he's like running across the island, being led around by Balk. And pretty soon you're in this underground lair where Ron Perlman is, you know, dusting off his Beauty and the Beast makeup to be the new Sayer of the Law. And then Marlon Brando shows up wearing white pancake makeup all over him. You know, in the context of the story, it's because he hates the heat, but it's basically just to make him look freakish. And then Val Kilmer's drawing a gun on Thewlis, and then they go to dinner, and then you've got this little midgety guy who is the inspiration for Mini-Me, turns out, in the second Austin Powers movie. No, basically, I mean, Mike Myers has said that. Yeah, the inspiration for Mini-Me was the fact that Marlon Brando has this little mutant version of him, which doesn't even make sense because he's supposed to be making animal people. He's not supposed to be, like, cloning little versions of himself. But, yeah, Nelson De La Rosa is the guy's name. He's definitely the creepiest thing in the movie because he's a little person who's wearing full-body prosthetic makeup to look like a mutant, and you see him naked at one point, and it's really hideous. if only they had used that hideousness to good effect instead of just kind of, you know, it's just kind of there. And in a way that the casual nature of Lawton's cruelty and weirdness isn't disturbing. It just feels like bad filmmaking is what it feels like. So
Well, it also,
I guess, yeah,
it also takes place in the future, and I remember that from before it came out, where it was in the future, because everything in the mid '90s was in the future a little bit, and that has nothing to do with the.
It has so little to do with it. I didn't even notice.
I sort of remembered it when I was watching and I was listening to it. Like, the world is at war and he works for the UN. Okay, so what? So what if he works for the UN? And then it never comes into it. At one point he accuses Montgomery of crashing his plane and kidnapping him. But there's no reason for them to do that, even after you find out that they've been experimenting on him a little. Which also makes no sense, because if they just need his blood or DNA, what's wrong with Montgomery or Moreau? And
it's not a good justification for keeping him around, like trying to mate him with the Panther Lady was in Island of Lost Souls.
And I find it interesting that Frankenheimer and Val Kilmer didn't get along, because there's no excuse from the screenplay standpoint why Val Kilmer's character. So in the second half, he just sort of becomes stranger and stranger. And it almost,
he just goes nuts for no reason.
And it's like, what, did Marlon Brando not film all the stuff he was supposed to? So you gave Val Kilmer a bunch of stuff to do, like, and it's really wacky stuff. Like, there's, you know, sort of him flirting with animal women and stuff. And you're just like, well, wait, is that actually a thing? Or are they just doing it for this? Because it starts out, and I think that Frankenheimer made the mistake of watching Jurassic Park before he made this. And that's not the model to follow. Because at the beginning, Val Kilmer is kind of like a stoned big game hunter. And yeah, he's second billed in the movie, and he doesn't have as much screen time as David Thewlis, except it's probably a little bit more useful. David Thewlis has this inexplicable scene where he's, like, looking through medical research, and it's like, well, how would he understand that? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, oh, he's all of a sudden, you know, a biologist? Like, no, he's, you know, a diplomat who talks about God a lot. And that was kind of weird when they talk about the experiments in terms of religion. And I was just like, well, is he supposed to be very religious? That wasn't established any time in the movie. But one of the notable things about it, one of the reasons I thought it had gotten famous was because is it South Park the movie or South Park the TV show?
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah, right in the first season of South Park, there's like a Dr. Moreau parody episode with a Marlon Brando-sounding version of Moreau who's making a pig animal. Oh, right. The episode was that, what is it? An elephant makes love to a pig. They've got, was it a Cartman has a pet elephant, and they want to see if they can mate it with a pig for some reason. So they go to, a Dr. Moreau figure. Wow, I totally forgot about that, but it's all coming back to me.
Yeah, and I thought that's why it had gotten.
I'm sorry, boys. Pig and elephant DNA just won't splice. Haven't you ever heard that song by Loverboy?
What song?
Dot and dude and pig and elephant DNA just won't.
So, yeah, who else is in this? I don't even know who. Because there's lots of animal people in it then. Besides Sarah DeLaw.
They broke the bank making up extras to look like animal people in this one.
Yeah, and
they're all out in broad daylight, so, you know, they have to look good. And they do, but
yeah,
to no effect.
Yeah, the hyena looks good, because there's three villains.
Right.
The animals. There's the first guy who, he kills the rabbit, and then he gets killed by one of Moreau. And that's the other thing, is Moreau has sort of his house slaves, and they get treated better than the field slaves. But in the house slaves, the girl gets treated better than the boys. So that comes in later. Like, I feel like the death scene of Firouza Balk was, like, really cruel in a way that,
it's kind of offhandedly cruel. I mean,
yeah,
and it's very abrupt. Almost like they just wanted to you know, get rid of her as quickly as possible to tie up that loose end. Because, yeah, when the animal people have revolted and they've got her in their clutches, they just say, oh, you know, the master always treated you so much better. And then they just hang her just from a noose, and it's a quick death.
Yeah, but the revolt in this one goes on for, oh, God, it feels like half the movie. But, oh, what about the little monkey scene? Oh, remember that?
A little monkey scene. I remember the little rat people. With
Yeah,
there's really, there's a really bad. There's a couple of really bad CG moments, but the worst one is, that's Olivia. Thulis is trying to escape by boat, and he finds a bunch of little rats who are walking on their hind legs and block him from escaping, and it's just real bad CG. But then another bad CG moment is when they're trying to the leopard guy who you mentioned earlier, he, you know, is running on his hind legs and then he's running on all fours and then he leaps, and it's a bad CG transition from the actor in makeup on his hind legs to a CG leopard on all fours jumping through the air.
Oh, but the villains, yeah. So he's the villain, then his friend's the villain, then one of the house slaves is the villain, then the hyena, who's the leopard man's friend, is the villain again. And it's just, it's just very confused. And
yeah, and it's also not very plausible how Thulis escapes from their clutches at the end. Basically just by convincing, you know, making them jealous of each other as to who's going to assume the leadership of the island. It's pretty childish stuff. That was probably one of those last minute script changes, like, how are we gonna get him out of danger here? Well, let's, you know, have him get them jealous of each other because they're just dumb animal people.
Yeah,
there's some bad dialogue where he's talking to one of them about, like, well, you know, you're the god, man, yeah. But, you know, but who gets to be god number one?
You know, I've seen it. I want to say two times, maybe three.
Before this?
Oh yeah, I saw it when it came out on video. I almost saw this in the theater, and I missed it, and it was gone by a week later, I feel like. But, yeah. No, I saw it on video, and I've had that conversation before where I was like, yeah, I thought Marlon Brando sucked, and this guy I was working with at a video store was like, he was fine, and I was like, oh, he was just, you know, he's no good. Like,
well, I guess the reason I didn't mind him and your friend didn't mind him either is because, like, he plays him as aloof.
And, yeah,
and if it's and it's genuine aloofness because Brando just doesn't give a shit. So, you know, if the character is going to be aloof, then it works. Like the scene you were mentioning where he's talking to Firuza Balk, and she's crying, and he just, you know, cracks a bad little joke and gets her to laugh. Like I bought that because, you know, yeah, this Moreau clearly doesn't give a care. Although, and this is what we were mentioning a little with Island of Lost Souls. He didn't care as far as, like, wanting to be seen as the father of, you know, the god of this island. He, you know, the animal men all have to refer to him as father, and he refers to them as his children. It's a far cry from the more overt kind of slavery that Lawton was engaging in. Although, like you just pointed out, this version has a little more, you know, overt kind of parables to slavery in that there's house slaves and field slaves.
Yeah, and
it's there, but it's like a missed opportunity. They don't do anything with that,
except for the one bad seed in the house, who decides he's going to revolt, and it.
It's kind of like, you know, you have to wonder what the original vision was for the movie, what Richard's original, you know, ideas for this were, because I have to imagine they were a little more intellectual than what we've got here. Because, I mean, if Island of Lost Souls is just a straight up, you know, creepy horror movie and very good at it, then Island of Dr. Moreau is like a failed pseudo intellectual science fiction action movie. And it gets really dumb. It gets a lot dumber than Island of Lost Souls ever did, because, like you said, like practically half the movie is taken up with this revolt of the animals. And, you know, by the end of by the last 20 minutes, it's just a lot of explosions and gunfire and running around.
Yeah, it's
they don't explore any ideas of what it is to be human and such. I mean, shoot, I mean, if they had had this really great point that could have explored those themes, then yeah, would have been great to hear Marlon Brando pontificating about the nature of humanity and stuff. But as it is, you've got about like five sentences of just kind of incoherent rambling, which David Thewlis actually calls him out on. He actually goes like, what you're saying doesn't mean anything. Like, you know, this doesn't justify anything that's happening here.
Yeah. Thewlis hated it. I feel like Frankenheimer's the real problem with a lot of it, because there appears to be narration straight out of the book.
It sounds like it could have come out of the book, sure.
Especially the bit at the end, talking about his journal and stuff. But Frankenheimer's, yeah, I mean, he and Thewlis haven't got a cohesive character. I guess Val Kilmer showed up for the set without having done any research or something. And Val Kilmer, of course, is very famous for his opinions about his character. So for him to have one, maybe that's why the guy's stoned half the time, is because Kilmer didn't want to do any work on it. So, yeah, I mean, it just feels like...
One thing that kind of had me shaking my head as far as Kilmer is concerned is at the point where he's just gone crazy for no reason, he starts doing a bad Marlon Brando imitation and showing up in the pancake makeup like to make fun of him. And it's like, did Brando know about this? Did, you know, was this Frankenheimer's way of expressing some irritation with?
Yeah, and that's what it feels like. It feels like there is no... I mean, they don't even connect that initial chase sequence to the beginning of the movie. And Frankenheimer has always been somebody that I feel like he did Manchurian Candidate, and then after that, he just sort of traded on that for the rest of his career.
Yeah, well, Seconds is supposed to be good.
That's right. We've talked about that before. Yeah.
See that? I haven't seen it before, but I'm going to be seeing it soon. But yeah, he definitely has traded on the Manchurian Candidate for the rest of his career.
But yeah, and it's just like think about how sensational this would have been if, you know, like Billy Friedkin had done it. Like, I just don't understand what kind of list New Line was going on, where they're like, John Frankenheimer, he's the one to do this, and that's why it makes me think that Brando had to okay somebody.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, we're almost to the point where they could remake it again with Val Kilmer doing...
doing Moreau.
Doing Moreau. But, It never looks, except for the CG with the Leopard Man thing you mentioned, it never looks cheap, because there are so many extras at so often doing so much. I mean, it's just such a big cast of these animal creatures that it's not ever believable that Val Kilmer could be the vet to all of them in a given day. I mean, it's just...
Yeah. Oh, and speaking of Law and Order, I mean, something that the original couldn't have was the idea that all the animal men have electronic implants,
right,
that buzz them with pain at the touch of Marlon Brando's remote control. Yeah, in the original, they're just being whipped into shape, but it's also a little more interesting because they're, you know, you get the idea that they've been reasoned with, that they've been indoctrinated into this orthodoxy of what it is to be man and why you need to obey the rules. Whereas, you know, in this version, it's like you don't obey the rules Well, you don't go to – it's not that you go to the House of the Pain. It's that you get the House of Pain delivered straight to you. So that's just asking for a rebellion because, yeah, the second they realize they can pull those pain chips out and the whole game is over. Yeah. I feel like Ron Perlman also was probably wasted in this because Ron Perlman's pretty great in everything, and if you've got him as like the very last scene of the movie is Thulis leaving the island on a boat, and he's talking to Ron Perlman, and it's sort of evident that Ron Perlman is going to be the leader of the island now, and he actually has a couple of good lines about, like, you know, no more scientists, you know, we'll just be what we are and not what Moreau tried to make us. And you're like, huh, I wish Ron Perlman had been in this movie a little more than the other animal guys who were just kind of dull antagonists.
Yeah, they were supposed to be scary for a variety of reasons. Leopard Man and Hyena Man were supposed to be scary because of the ferocity of the animals, and the rebelling house slave is just supposed to be gross looking, I think. And then there's a sweet one who walks around just like out of it. But yeah, it's just...
Also, they really missed an opportunity with Firouza Balk. I kept waiting for the scene where, like, you know, where Thulis finds cat ears under her hair or something like that. But the most you get out of the revelation that she used to be an animal is some sharp canines.
Yeah, and she meows when she's getting killed. She's sort of a screeching meow that seems like they threw it in later because, yeah. No, you don't even, in the original, you get to see some of the reversion. In this, you don't really get to see any because it goes too fast. That they're talking about the regression during that scene with Marlon Brando when he's disinterested in Firouza Balk busting her ass to pretend to be a cat girl.
One more thing about Brando. Doesn't it seem like the casting of Brando as an eccentric who lives on an island full of natives that he lords over, doesn't that seem like a joke on Brando himself? Because that's kind of like what he became infamous for, was like living on private islands and, you know, fathering children with the native girls. I don't remember when stories like that started to surface, but I mean, certainly by the time Moreau was made, that's kind of like the lifestyle he was almost living in real life.
Yeah, and I mean, to some degree,
it's like, did he? So when he heard about this role, like, did he not realize that, like, by taking this role, he's practically doing self-parody?
Well, I think he took a lot of these roles to pay for court costs. Remember, his son was on trial in the 90s or something.
Oh,
I don't know. I think he had lots of debts he had to pay, so he started acting again. But yeah, I mean, it's like Frankenheimer was kind of like playing like a sweet Colonel Kurtz.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And because Brando had been doing the I tape my lines to shit since at least Superman. Mm-hmm. And maybe earlier. And, you know, Superman, he can do it. But in this one, you know, you're just kind of like, because what's his reasoning was that, by seeing the lines, it was more spontaneous. But of course, he had just done Don Juan DeMarco, so he was actually like sort of at a comeback, and then that went away almost immediately after this.
It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. It was just lame, especially coming off of Island of Lost Souls. It makes me really curious about the 77 version with Michael York and I think Burt Lancaster.
Yeah. And that one, yeah, I've never heard anything about it either way.
I think it was referenced in an Angry Youth Comics issue, the first one. But Yeah, it's Lodi McGee's favorite movie, apparently, from Angry Youth Comics. That's all I know about it. I mean, I've heard it like, man, you never hear anything bad about it.
No,
so
yeah.
It might be a kind of a undiscovered little gem. But with this one, yeah, I mean, people don't even remember this as – this was such like a – Island of Dr. Moreau 96 is such a product of its time as far as being like a bomb of its time, because you've got like – Val Kilmer's career troubles meeting Marlon Brando's career troubles meeting John Frankenheimer's career stagnancy
meeting.
When was Ronin? Ronin was the year before this, right?
2 years later.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right.
But so, then Reindeer Games was after that. So, you know, Frankenheimer, Ronin was a hit. I hated that movie. I remember seeing it in the theater and I hated it. But it was a reasonable enough hit. And then Reindeer Games like was his opus. And, you know, it's another punchline movie, but also this was, you know, this attempt to turn David Thewlis into a Hollywood leading man that went nowhere. And poor Fairuza Balk sort of, after this, was relegated to a supporting role in almost.
But The Craft was the year after this.
Was
so...
it? Was it 97?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
she came out all right.
Yeah.
Oh, and American History X. She hadn't even done that yet.
Yeah. So.
So this movie didn't sink her. I mean, yeah, Ron Perlman and Fairuza Balk, I think, came out the best out of this. And nobody even remembers that Ron Perlman was in this, so much the better for him.
Yeah, it's
also about the script too. I mean, you know, who know, you know, if they were rewriting, who knows what the original script was like. But I find it interesting that Michael Hare is one of the credited screenplay authors on this. Michael Hare was the guy who wrote Dispatches, and that became the basis of Full Metal Jacket, which he also co-wrote. So, but you look at this and it's just like where's the sense that the guy who wrote Dispatches and Full Metal Jacket had anything to do with this? Because Full Metal Jacket, as far as, you know, examinations of man's inhumanity to man, is pretty good. This isn't.
Well, so, yeah, on the IMDb trivia page, they said Barbara Steele was originally cast as Moreau's wife, and then Frankenheimer had her written out of the script. Barbara Steele, I think, is Barbara Steele from the Corman movies? And Gallo stuff? Or
Yeah, those... Yeah, Italian horror movies of the 60s, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was like definitely a Richard Stanley type thing, like, because he's a genre guy. But, yeah, so, I mean, Frankenheimer must have changed a lot, but they had already been shooting, so what exactly got shot in those first 4 days? Like, what was Val Kilmer even on set yet? Because, yeah, there's probably good stories about this. It's, you know, we do this with our bad movies sometimes. Didn't we say this about Memoirs, that
the story of the making of has to be more interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, at least with Memoirs there was special effects making of too. With this one, it's good makeup. I mean, it's good makeup for a genre movie from a studio that didn't really do genre type thing, but it's before Weta Design did everything, so it has its own personality. But yeah, it's I don't think I ever have to see it again now. I think I'm done.
Yeah, and it's not bad enough in interesting ways that you can recommend it as like a bad movie worth seeing either. Oh, and one thing that is confusing to me, I remember you pointed out that the original theatrical cut isn't available anywhere.
Yeah.
Because what we watched is the director's cut, which I guess is the only video release that there's ever been.
Yeah.
But the director's cut is only 4 minutes longer than the theatrical one, evidently. So,
yeah. So maybe...
What were those 4 minutes that were, you know, so essential to the complete vision of John Frankenheimer?
That was going to fix it. Yeah, that was going to fix this movie. Like, what was it? And, yeah... Maybe the original cut was structured differently or something, and a little bit better. Who knows? But yeah, it's Because I wanted to find that, but yeah, nobody's ever... They released this one on video. This has been the version since it came out in probably 97 on video.
Yep. Ugh. Mm-hmm. Ugh. Ugh is right. Okay.
So next time we're going to be doing a different brand of ugh for the second movie.
Yeah, we're shifting gears. No more H.G. Wells classic 1930s horror movies. We're switching gears to comedy and taking a look at a comedy classic of sorts, Arthur, from, what, 1982?
1981 or 80, yeah.
Yeah, starring Dudley Moore. And I've never seen it.
It's great. Yeah, it's awesome. The second
then
one, however, yeah.
Then we're going to look at Arthur 2, which didn't come out until 7 years later. Arthur 2, On the Rocks, which, did they get Liza Minnelli back? Yeah,
they got
did.
Liza Minnelli back. John Gielgud comes back as a ghost, supposedly. Now, of course, the guy who wrote Arthur tragically died right after he made Arthur. And he's sort of famous among comedy screenwriters because of how well written Arthur is. And so, yeah, then it took, you know, Warner Brothers 7 years to decide that they need to try and turn this into a franchise, sort of in that first wave of sequels in the late 80s where anything could get a sequel.
Well, Caddyshack also got a
Warner Brothers
a sequel in 88.
Yep.
Oh, wow, Warner Brothers. All right, so I guess we'll have to get into that. Right, so next episode, Arthur and Arthur 2 on the rocks for an Alan Smithy podcast. This has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.
You're late.